Okay, well, we'll get started. I apologise for the terrible day and the awful weather. This is not what I was promised when I came to Australia 8 months ago. But I'm particularly delighted because of the terrible weather to see so many of you here this evening for the fourth in our 2012 series of Centre for Public Policy public forums, which tonight features two of Victoria and arguably Australia's most distinguished public servants, Mr. Terry Moran and Mr. Yehudi Blatcher, who are here to discuss fit for purpose, how the Australian public services can meet the challenges of the next two decades, five themes for improvement. My name's Helen Sullivan, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm Professor and Director of the Centre for Public Policy here at the University of Melbourne, and I'm chairing tonight's session. As we begin, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land, and pay respect to the elders both past and present of the Kulin Nation, and extend that respect to any other Indigenous Australians present. Those of you on the CPP mailing list will be familiar with the work of the Centre and our programme of events and activities. To those of you not on the CPP mailing list, the question is, well, why not? Please do join. That way you'll get prior notification of some of our upcoming events. All it takes is an email address, which you can leave with us or register via our website. And at this point, I'd like to mention that our next forum on the 7th of August, when hopefully the weather won't be like this, will feature Tony Nicholson, the Executive Director of the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence. But back to tonight's session and my introduction to our two distinguished guests. Mr. Terry Moran, AC, has had a varied public sector career, working with successive Australian federal and state governments in public policy and public sector management. His early career as a CEO focused on building Australia's education and technical skills capacity. But in 2000, Mr. Moran was appointed Secretary of the Department of Premier and Cabinet in Victoria, where he played a leading role in developing an ambitious national reform agenda, subsequently agreed by all states and the Commonwealth Government. Mr. Moran was Secretary of the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet from March 2008 to September 2011, overseeing further development and implementation of this national reform agenda, particularly through social policy. He was also responsible for overseeing work on national security and international policy, environment, industry and economic policy, and coordination of government administration, including cabinet support. He also played a lead role in driving reforms in the Australian public service. In January 2012, Mr. Moran was honoured with the Order of Australia Companion for his eminent service to the community through public sector leadership, including policy development, programme delivery, and effective governance. Unsurprising in one who has challenged existing institutions at state and federal levels, Terry sees the role of a public servant as offering frank and fearless advice, and he was quoted earlier this year as saying that one of the highest virtues of a public servant would be respect for scepticism. Yehudi Blatcher, who will be our respondent this evening, is currently Deputy President of the Institute of Public Administration Australia. Yehudi joined the Victorian Public Service in 1980, and for over a 30-year period, he held a variety of senior positions, both policy and operational, each dealing with major reforms to different aspects of the public sector. He was awarded the Public Service Medal in 2012 for his outstanding service in the instigation, promotion, and implementation of innovative reforms in public administration. An award he acknowledged with what I am growing to appreciate as I get to know Yehudi is with his customary modesty, saying you don't expect these things for working within your profession. He continues his work in part through his relatively new role as a professorial fellow with the Centre for Public Policy here at the University of Melbourne. So you will see that tonight we are in both safe and sage hands. The format for this evening will be the usual format. Terry Moran will speak for 40 minutes or so, outlining his arguments, and then Yehudi will offer a response for about 10 to 15 minutes. We will then open the session up for the audience for questions and discussion. And as usual, we are recording the event because very many people who do take great interest in what the Centre does and do watch our live, well, not live, but our recorded broadcasts now expect us to record these. So I do hope that everybody's okay with that. There will be a post-event reception, as usual, in the auditorium, and we would very much like you to stay and join us for that. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Mr. Terry Moran to come and address you.
Well, Professor Sullivan, thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you, everybody in the room, for braving a very unpleasant night. I thought I was driving here, but then I found that my daughter knocked off my car, so I had to try and get a taxi as everybody else was trying to do the same thing, but I eventually made it. Over the last 30 years or so, public sector reform has been linked to and very much part of broader economic, social and more recently environmental reforms. Take competition reform or competition policy, for example. It's clearly microeconomic reform in its orientation. It's introduced things like competitive neutrality for many parts of the government system, emphasised competition within newly framed markets. It's led to the breakup and often privatisation of government business enterprises, and it's also spurred a whole lot of new and hopefully useful regulatory arrangements. And the Productivity Commission a few years ago assessed that it had probably added about 2% to GDP growth in Australia. But it's also a very significant public sector reform, and so it's at the nexus between the broader economic and social reform on the one hand and public sector reform on the other. So one could say that what was once a detached, secure, even insulated public service has moved substantially over the last 30 years. Privatisation, I've already mentioned, and not too far away from privatisation has been outsourcing. And so the jobs network, federally, would be an example of that, where once there was the Commonwealth Employment Service. Hopefully people in the room here didn't have to be clients of that organisation too often. It had an opportunity eventually to compete as a public provider, but failed through competition very quickly, and now the delivery of the jobs network is in the hands of either companies or not-for-profit organisations. Other changes have been more emphasis on accountability for performance, and this has been particularly driven through reforms in the budget process and how activities in government are measured. IT has had a huge impact on services delivery and management, in part because it's speeded up and magnified the amount of data that can be accessed and analysed, but also in more recent times it's been a prime vehicle for service delivery itself. In Victoria, and more recently elsewhere, but in Victoria since the late 80s, we've had growing emphasis on the so-called purchaser-provider split, popularised by a couple of Americans who were later picked up by an American vice president as the champions of a particular approach to public sector reform. I've mentioned competition policy. Managers, particularly senior managers in departments and agencies, have been given greater freedom to manage with more discretion over budgets, staff, and in many cases the assets as well. There's been a gradual withering away of old-style concepts of tenure, and there's also been much more emphasis on external recruitment, including at the executive level. And there's a broader policy literacy outside government, so that on many important issues, even if it's not the age that reports it, elsewhere there can be debates between well-informed people with different perspectives on the important issues of our time. And then finally, there have been very major financial reforms within the public sector, which have not quite been as successful as the early enthusiasts for program budgeting had hoped, but nonetheless have had a very big impact on how well public funds are used. So one could say that largely over that period of time, there's been a positive impact from these reforms, but it's also true to say that the public service world is far from perfect. Australia itself has done well out of the broader policy-driven reforms, as well as these public sector reforms. So if you look back, not just to the early 80s, but go further back to the late 60s and mid 70s, we've gone down a path of much greater global economic engagement. We've seen continuing structural change in the economy, and that's not just been in manufacturing, but in other areas as well. So for example, education export is now a very large and important export industry. It barely existed in the early 80s. And by and large, the workforce required in most industries has had to become more highly skilled, whether that be through the offerings of universities or offerings within the vocational education and training sector, and many of the activities people in many sectors undertake are higher value in terms of, and higher complexity in terms of their impact, and hopefully better for the economy and better for the individuals concerned. So we've had economic growth, we've had increasing prosperity, and Australia as an economy has been tested in a series of crises, most recently the global financial crisis, and now, as would be acknowledged by many people, but not all people in our society, we're probably the best performing developed economy, and this is due not just to the success of the resources sector, but it's due to other parts of the economy, indeed parts of the economy that were negligible in their size and impact in the 80s, early 80s, but have since become much more important. And even medical research and what it leads to is part of that, but so too is tourism, education export, and a burgeoning services to the resources sector part of the economy, plus a reconfigured manufacturing centre that's increasingly supporting investment in the resources sector. But there are other success stories as well. So as at the end of March, we've got GDP growth over a 12-month period of 4.3%, which I've just been to Europe for 2 weeks, and from that perspective, that looks astonishing. We've got very low public debt. That looks astonishing. We've got robust economic institutions. That's not as common in the developed world as some might expect. We've got low unemployment, 5.1%. I was in Madrid a bit over a week ago. Total unemployment, 25%. Youth unemployment of 50%. The budget will return to surplus in the year commencing the 1st of July. Business investment is up, and it's not all going into the resources sector. And industrial disputes have continued to trend down, although there are a couple of industry areas where there are the odd exception. And along with all of this, we've had major social policy reforms. Can't go through them all, but obviously health and education are important. And in post-school education, by way of an example, there's been a huge increase in enrolments, participation, completions and so forth. But there have also been quite massive changes to welfare benefits, which have meant that we haven't gone down the same path as many of the European countries, and as a result got into all sorts of trouble more generally with a government sector in the economy that would be much, much greater as a percentage of GDP than it is here in Australia. And in the last few years, we've had a new or another spate of reform. The responses to climate change, which are still controversial, with a market-based mechanism for pricing carbon emissions coming into effect from the 1st of July. We've had the beginning of the rollout of the National Broadband Network, which is not only likely to be a transformative economy, transformative influence within the economy and a source of productivity improvement, but it will have big impacts on areas like health and education, and it's also a test by the Commonwealth Government of a new way of doing really big infrastructure projects where it's all taken outside a traditional departmental structure and in this case put into a company, a private sector organisation with its own specialist board of private sector people and highly capable executives and managers brought in from outside as well. We've had the beginning of another series of reforms on public hospitals agreed with all states and territories in the Commonwealth last year through the Council of Australian Governments. We've had pension increases, although the pensioners don't seem to fully understand that. We're about to embark upon a national disability insurance scheme, which has been worked through already by the Productivity Commission, as they've also looked at how we could reform the struggling aged care sector in Australia. And beneath all of these things, where it comes to domestic policy, you've had a rewriting of the rule book on Commonwealth State financial relations, although I'm not sure Brian is as enthusiastic about it as sometimes I am. So all of these things, and many others that I haven't mentioned, represent a very considerable policy load that's been picked up by parts of the Commonwealth and the state and territory public services, but an even bigger implementation and service delivery load, particularly at the state and territory level and in a few Commonwealth Government departments. But the public remains grumpy and unhappy. And I think it was last week in Crikey, they reported the results of some attitudes research, and one question and the answers to it really struck me. So the question was, do you agree or disagree with this proposition? An active government is necessary to provide services and to protect ordinary Australians from unfair policies and practices on the part of large financial and or industrial groupings. The total agreeing with that statement was 67%. ALP and Greens voters registered 82% agreement, but to my astonishment, LNP voters registered 59%. It's not quite what I would have expected. But that general approach, through surveys done by a variety of people, including at least one survey that's benchmarked against US results done in Australia by Quantum, that result has been there in data that I've seen over the last 15 or 20 years quite consistently. So through all this period of reform, the Australian public was not at one with many other people who wanted to pare back government or dramatically change its role in our society. I'm not making a judgment as to whether we should pare it back or whatever, but I'm simply saying that perhaps true to our colonial past or our convict past, there are still lots of people who are pretty good at admiring what the colonies invented in penal times and what's persisted as a theme through Australian government since then, something that Laura Tingle has written about recently in her essay on Great Expectations. And then you might say, well, if people think that about government, they're probably in favour of big government, but they're not. 44% of people agreed with the proposition that government is too large. So the government wants, rather, people want stuff that government can do, but they want it presumably cheaply done and modestly presented. So that takes me into public sector reform. And since the Coombs Royal Commission report was published in 1976, there have been a number of goes at public service reform in Australia. Coombs himself had been set up by Gough Whitlam at the urging of Peter Walensky, who was then sent off to run the secretariat for the Coombs Royal Commission for a while. And Walensky was sort of the leading edge of insurgent baby boomers in the Commonwealth Public Service. Although he wasn't genuinely a baby boomer himself, he sort of stood for that cause. By that I mean these were the younger people who wanted to knock off the old mandarins and see a surge of younger people coming through into senior positions. And by and large they were successful, and they didn't really need a Royal Commission to achieve it. But nonetheless, Coombs reported in terms of emphasising a public service that was more responsive to government, involved the community more and got out into the community more, and more emphasis on results-based management. But having been started by Whitlam, Coombs reported to Fraser, and Fraser had made a point politically of stressing that he was different to Whitlam and was very much the traditionalist in terms of how the public service should operate. And it's one of the many things that I'm very fond of in terms of Malcolm Fraser's view of life. So Coombs was a long narrative. I think it was about 5 volumes, although many of the volumes were consultancy reports written by academics and others. But although it was a long narrative, an intricate narrative, some would say it was low impact. So the impact for the length wasn't quite as you would have expected. In 1980, there was a review of Commonwealth functions, which led to some trimming at the Commonwealth level. There was a new Public Service Reform Act in 1984, which came out of an initiative taken by John Dawkins as Finance Minister in the first Hawke government. And indeed, the report on which that was based was written, as if I'm correct in my memory, by Roger Beale, who retired as a Commonwealth Departmental Secretary a few years ago. And one of the things that that Act provided for was an ability to deploy senior leaders within the public service more readily, including, I think, the establishment of the senior executive service concept. In 1987, at the urging of Peter Walensky, the Public Service Board, the Central Personnel Agency, was eliminated, and it was easier to get at secretaries as a result of that. And in 1996, there were further changes which made secretaries employment based on contracts with performance expectations. And then in 1999, there was some fitting of values in and an emphasis on the merit principle and a stronger role for the Public Service Commission. Now, all of this stuff is for most people, and I'm sure that includes most people here tonight, eye-glazingly boring. But the point of it is that all of these reform themes have to do with the internal HR processes of government. And you'd say, well, why is it so? Because there was a parallel stream of reform that emphasised financial management issues, and I think ultimately that parallel stream had more impact and was of more consequence than the traditional public service reform agenda. And I think the principal reason that this was all a bit dull was that it never encouraged the public service to come to terms ultimately with the connection between what the public service did or delivered and citizens. And that was the point that the reform review that I was responsible for, which led to a report called Ahead of the Game, that was what it was trying to say. It was trying to say, well, all this other stuff is important and we're doing useful things, but at the end of the day, citizens are number one, and that indeed was the first of four themes in the report, Ahead of the Game. There were a few other things in it, but I won't go through it in detail, but one important issue from my point of view is that it defined the roles of departmental secretaries, and one of them was put forward as being stewardship. Stewardship as individuals in respect of their own departments as public service institutions, and stewardship collectively as a group of secretaries for the quality and capacity of the public service as a whole. And I can report that this was debated quite a lot amongst the Commonwealth departmental secretaries and strongly supported as a concept. They perhaps were looking back to Barmier days, I'm not sure, but they all willingly embraced that, and the consequences of it, which included a further strengthening of the role of the Public Service Commission, and having put money in when the government then took money out from that reform effort just before the last election. After the election, all the secretaries got together and said, don't worry, we'll find the money ourselves in our departments and give it to the Public Service Commission so that with one exception, the Commission can get on with the reforms, and so it's proved to be the case. But in any event, Ahead of the Game still had that strong emphasis on the internal HR issues within the public service, and you can see why that's so, because so much reform was needed there in order to better equip the public service to either contribute to the policy debates within government about those reforms, which began, depending upon how far you look back, in the mid-70s or the early 80s, and I think those reforms could have been better, but they took the public services a long way down the path of being adept at dealing with that reform challenge. So to think about where the public service is going now, I for my part think that you can't do that unless you have a focus on what the new challenges are for government. And one could have any number of them, and I won't dwell on them for long, but I've got five and I'll just mention those. So firstly, there's a challenge for government in citizen expectations. There's what one could derive from those survey results that I mentioned about what people think about the role of government. There's always still, despite the reforms, a big Commonwealth-state relations component, and there's also an issue about how responsive the public services are to citizens and their needs. The second big challenge is competitiveness in the economy. So we've got the usual issues like tax reform, industrial relations reform. We've got the challenge of accelerated structural adjustment in export-exposed parts of the economy. We've got a decline in relative educational performance, particularly in schooling. where the countries that are improving are those in our region of the world, and we ought to be deeply worried about what the PISA testing is showing about that decline in relative educational performance. And then in the under the competitiveness heading, we've got the inevitable worry all the time about how well we're going, how successful we'll be in a global economy, which in large part, particularly Europe and the United States, is highly stressed at the moment, such that we can't necessarily assume the sorts of global GDP growth and our share of it that was there over the last few years. The third big issue is Australia in its relations with US and China. As has been often said, our strategic relationship, that is our defence and foreign policy relationship, is with the United States, but increasingly our economic interests are tied to China, and there's a lot of truth in that, but then it steps down to a whole lot of challenging issues. For instance, what will be the future source of foreign direct investment into Australia, and what expectations will come with that foreign direct investment when it comes in here? How will the markets in which we participate, which are now largely Asian markets in terms of our trade, emerge over time? And how will this growing ambivalence between the US and China and its effect on Australia play out in the big non-strategic, that is non-defence or foreign policy related challenges of climate change and food security, which I think there's still strong expert opinion to support the contention that they'll be very big issues into the future. The fourth big challenge is around domestic services, the unrequited expectations of citizens for more in health, more in education, more in infrastructure, and the disgrace of the unresolved issues about Indigenous Australians, particularly in remote Australia, despite vast amounts of money being poured into communities, and at least since the late 70s, making things worse rather than better. And it's in this area of domestic services, plus public safety and at the Commonwealth level defence, that most public sector employees are now engaged. So whatever the policy challenges might be, how well those services go has got a lot to do with how well tuned that majority of public servants at a national level, I shouldn't say public servants, public sector employees at a national level and at a state and territory level are going. And the fifth big challenge, as it's been since the Second World War, but it's probably, if anything, getting a bit bigger, and that is coping with the massive diversity in our population. And by that I mean the different backgrounds of people, whether it be national, language, ethnicity, backgrounds, and the associated differences in the skill profiles that people can bring into the economy, and as a result of that, the level of success in economic terms which they can expect. Also, many of these groups have assumptions about government that are different to the assumptions of the, the Anglo-Saxon Irish heritage of the country that's basically been dominant in the way our constitution was formed and how the conventions governing our system of government emerged, particularly at the national level, for over the last century. So on this challenges front, we dodged the post-GFC economic bullet, but there was actually more to it in our case than booming resources, because all those other reforms had added to the diversity and strength of our economy. But I think that the sort of challenges and others that I haven't mentioned mean that complacency shouldn't dominate our thinking into the future. So how does government, in particular the public services, improve to cope with these and other challenges? And I think there are 5 points. Policy linkage, which is really about the relevance of what the public service does, but also is it focusing its efforts on the high priority initiatives which will yield most either for community wellbeing or for GDP growth. Accountability in the sense of can we get maximum impact for what the public services do, as well as tighter lines of responsibility to individuals and groups for achieving that impact. Citizens, improving their satisfaction, but many other things besides. Efficiency, that's that lower cost issue. And then finally, the role of government. Government's got to hold the ring, even if it's not doing everything as it might have done in the past to deliver what the citizens want. So firstly, policy linkage. Well, it's sort of going to be a matter of policy for some time that we face a period of fiscal constraint. At the moment, Commonwealth government revenues are appreciably below the average take as a percentage from GDP of the Commonwealth government over recent years, and that's largely because Commonwealth revenues are down in selected areas. It was thought they would have come back by now, but they haven't. And when they do come back, there will inevitably be a bit of a debate about what's done with the money, tax reform or expenditure, essentially, or paying down debt. But there'll be fiscal constraint apart from that that once-off step up in revenue as we return to the long-term average of Commonwealth revenues as a proportion of GDP. Secondly, goes back to the point I made a moment ago, that the policy priorities for the future ought to be around what will have biggest impact on GDP growth and the general well-being of the community. The Grattan Institute's recently done some work put out under the heading Game Changers. The Productivity Commission has from time to time also done work on the impact on GDP of selected reforms. And the point of all this is that there's a choice to be made. You can't do everything, but if you make the wrong choice, you don't necessarily get the best results. In other words, if you make the wrong choice, there's an opportunity cost in that, which is higher growth than would have been the case if you'd made the right choice, and also perhaps greater community well-being as well. Another part of the policy linkage is the general tendency on governments in response to the community to increase the number of channels for delivering services, often outside government, and how that's going to be handled. And then finally, there's a huge implementation issue that's under this heading, I think, because if you can get better implementation, people will have more confidence in the results that government can deliver, and will do better at living within the resources rather than finding that things run over the original estimates and more money's got to be found. On the accountability issue, I think there are five broad themes, and this is probably the most complicated area in one sense. Despite all the work on accountability over the last 25 or 30 years, it's still the case that it's often opaque as to who is responsible to achieve results, and it's also often opaque as to how you'd measure them, even if you did know who was responsible for them. And there are also often very, very weak consequences for bad or non-delivery of the things that are supposed to be done. So identifying who is accountable to deliver things sounds really simple, and it's been a theme of public service reform for a long time, but in reality, it's much harder than people think, and there's a long way to go to sort that out. Secondly, and this is a bit esoteric, but at the Commonwealth level and at the state level, there are governance differences between departments of state, on the one hand, and agencies on the other. And at the Commonwealth level, as a result of the so-called URIG reforms in the period of John Howard's government, a lot of things were shifted out of agencies into departments, and many of those departments have been made confused policy and delivery conglomerates that are massively underperforming, bloated with staff, and really not doing a particularly good job. It'd be much better if some of their functions were peeled off again, put with agencies that had expert boards, quality leadership, specialist skills within them to get the job done, and is, as part of doing that, a merit approach to selecting the boards rather than just making political appointments would be a good thing to do as well. And a good example of this sort of thing working well would be the National Broadband Network Company, which has indeed got its board members largely through a merit-based process. The Australian Taxation Office, which everybody doesn't particularly love, is nonetheless, by international standards, a highly effective agency, and it is effective for a number of reasons, including that it's not a conventional ministerial department and can basically manage itself so that it gets on with the job. And a third example of getting stuff out of departments would be the state of Victorian public hospitals, which have, over a number of decades, gone further and further into the position of being self-governing institutions, and they're probably the best in Australia, and they would be seen by many people overseas as a perfect example of how to get it right in designing delivery, even though we in Victoria might occasionally fret about the queues at emergency departments. So if you put more stuff out with agencies, that means that departments themselves, departments of state, ministerial departments, have much less involvement in direct service delivery. Support ministers in respect of policy, legislation, budgets, keeping an eye on results, public presentation. But basically the theme for government departments should be, in my view, less is more. They should be smaller, they should be more focused, but they should do what they are left with better than in some cases they do at the moment. The skills needed in departments are therefore likely to be rather different to the skills needed in most of the agencies that I've been talking about. The third issue under accountability is the role of ministers, and in particular the decay in ministerial responsibility. It used to be the case that ministers could be clear about what they're responsible for, but I think most of that's fallen away, and if you're not clear about what you're responsible for, you're actually not responsible for anything. And therefore, you'll notice in the media occasionally there's a bit of fuss about whether people are taking responsibility for things at a ministerial level. But the reality is it's now so confused that in a parliamentary democracy, the key linkage between the executive branch and the parliament, which is the person of the minister, and that person's responsibility to the parliament for their administration of legislation and departments and so forth, has largely broken down. And it's a danger to our parliamentary democracy to leave that unremarked and unattended to. And I think that it's vitally important that we have a broader debate about how to better define what ministers are accountable for in a real sense, and then for them to be held accountable for those things. The fourth theme is Commonwealth-state relations. It's everybody's punching bag, particularly the business communities. The truth is it's not as bad as it seems. The 2008 federal financial relations reforms have improved things a good deal. There's still further work to be done. But the point is that the Commonwealth's got to stay out of some things that are best left for the states to do. And in the social policy area, what the Commonwealth does best is provide benefits or vouchers, regulate activities, sets prices for different sorts of services, and then pays attention to performance through the analysis and publication of data. The Commonwealth is, by and large, hopeless at actually delivering the services, and it's particularly poor at trying to be in touch with local communities and what they're on about. To compensate for that distance, what's emerged in quite a number of departments, about half a dozen at the Commonwealth level, is what I call programmatic confetti. Hundreds of discretionary grants programs which enable little bits of money to be scattered all over the landscape in the hope that people will be grateful for that and see the Commonwealth's good works at the local level. Truth is, it's expensive, the overheads are high, and it doesn't have, usually, a big impact on the quality of service delivery anyway. So there are a whole lot of issues around Commonwealth-state relations, and the states, for their part, have got to go more in the direction of the Victorian model, which stresses self-governing institutions with devolved authority to get things done, an independent assessment of the results delivered and the price to be paid for their services, and wherever possible, a fairly rigorous approach to not only collecting that performance data but publishing it as well. And then the final issue under accountability, and it's the obverse of the coin of ministerial responsibility, is senior officials and the parliament. And I think that particularly agency officials should have more direct accountability to the department, but so too should senior people in departments. Annual reports from agencies, departments and departments should be, frankly, more revealing of what those bodies are doing rather than a PR blurb. And there's even a role, in my view, for a well-behaved and sensible parliamentary committee to have a role in the appointment process for secretaries and some agency heads. So what this means is that there ought to be more lines in from the executive branch to the parliament, so that not everything is focused on the persona of the minister. And if that's the case, you can afford a system that is more precise about what the minister is actually responsible for, rather than assuming a minister is responsible for everything, which is undoubtedly going to end up causing lots of ministers, perhaps after they leave office, to die sooner than would otherwise be the case. Then there's the theme of citizens, and that's really about a citizen-centric approach, and one size doesn't fit all. Quality and responsiveness is expected, and there are a whole lot of things that can be done by how you structure service delivery systems with an emphasis on devolution, measurement of results, accountability for delivery, which I won't go through, it might come up later. But the story is really about going local if you want to make citizens happy, while at the same time harvesting the benefits of the digital environment to do through digital channels much more stuff on a centralised level, but in a way that people can access in their home or workplace. And governments in Australia are in some respects leading the way internationally on the digital delivery of services, but that's not well recognised yet, and there's still a long way to go before a lot of those services are better joined up than they've been in the past. There's then the efficiency theme, and a lot of that falls out of what I've been saying. If you've got clearer roles for ministers, departments, agencies, various jurisdictions, you can save a lot on overheads and you can get things done faster and better. The programmatic confetti thing, which wastes billions of dollars, should be cleaned up. There are a whole lot of things that need to be done about capability in the public service, which would improve both effectiveness and efficiency. And on the policy front, where for 30 years we've been in love with the products of economic analysis as the basis for most but not all of the policy work government does, increasingly economic analysis has got to sit alongside what I'd call strategic analysis and planning, which is a way of getting inside what's going on in the big service delivery systems in a far more professional way than has been the case in most areas up until now. And given that I said before, most public servants at the national level, at the state level, are actually involved in delivery, there are quite a number of ways in which, in a technical sense, the management of that delivery could be improved, but I won't go into that detail. Then there's finally the role of government, and it really comes down to how do you match a fairly inelastic share of GDP being available as revenue for government to elastic expectations on the part of the community. And I think it really will call forth a lot more effort on explaining to the community the choices that are available and finding ways to explain why some things won't be done. And it also means that government's got to content itself with a role that focuses on it being the funder and the orchestrator of a lot of delivery, rather than the entity that has to always own the vehicles of delivery, which was the assumption 50, 100 years ago. And so come back to the themes, the policy link, accountability, citizens, efficiency, the role of government. There are some hard choices to be made about what governments can do, but the right choices mean you get dividends in terms of greater economic growth and greater community well-being. And if you just make the choices on a seat of the pants basis, you're left with luck as to whether you've got the right ones or not. There has to be an emphasis on treating people at the delivery end with much more respect, I think, in terms of standing in the system. Victoria is probably the best case in Australia for getting that right. We need much tighter accountability for people at all levels as to what they're supposed to deliver and what they do deliver. We've got to accept that the community wants more, but it's got to be for less, and therefore we've got to cut out waste, and there's still waste to be cut out. And there has to ultimately be a refreshed understanding between governments and the community about what the way forward is and what can realistically be done by government and what can't. So the sort of things that, and believe it or not, I've probably, under my five themes, I've probably covered about 30 different improvement initiatives that might be taken, and I apologise for that, but I started out with about 50, so I think I was doing pretty well. But it's essentially an emphasis on improvement, not radical transformation. That's been the interesting thing about Australia. Australia hasn't taken radical steps in public service reform, although it did take some radical steps with things like privatisation for the broader public sector. But within the heart of the public sector, you've got the public services, and they've evolved sensibly over time. And in that, we're rather like the UK and the other Westminster tradition governments in the world. I'm an optimist. Having been around for a long time now, I see huge change since the late 70s. I see better results being delivered. I don't think the institutional ethos of the public service has been destroyed. It's still there, well and truly strong. And Australia still manages to attract many fine people to its public services, and many of those fine people stick around and make a major contribution, as they always did want to do, to Australia and its welfare. So they'd be my five themes under the acronym PACER.
As usual, and I've heard many of Terry's speeches, Terry's provided us with a very wide-ranging speech, rich in history and substance. And as I was sort of reflecting on what I might say, I find that there's probably nothing in his speech that I would disagree with. Maybe that's in part because, like Terry, I've been around for a long time, and if you take the sort of broad historical perspective, then there's been a trajectory of significant improvements, both in the quality of public services and the way in which public services operate over the last 20 or 30 years of essentially my professional life. What I want to do then is, rather than reiterate particular points that Terry's made to help you sort of gauge the questions that you might ask, I just want to touch on two or three issues that I think bear a bit more emphasis. The first issue is the issue that underpins the subtext, I guess, of the title of Terry's speech. The subtitle is How Public Services Can Meet the Challenges of the Next Two Decades. And I'd like to suggest that the mix of skills and capabilities that Australian public services have to exhibit over the next two decades depends on the answer to a prior question, and it was touched on in Terry's speech. What are the most appropriate forms of delivery of public services in the country? And over the past three decades, we've seen a continuous move, both Commonwealth and state level, of services to be provided by other agencies other than government directly. Among the states, that trend has been very uneven, but I think it's fair to say that in Victoria, it's been the most pronounced. Corporatisation, privatisation, contracting out to non-government and private providers are all in the mix. And on the assumption that this trend will continue, the key question for public services around Australia is, do they have the skills to manage the varying relationships that are embedded in the different modes of service delivery? And I think it's fair to say that the report card on this is probably mixed. In general, I think we do pretty well. And despite the often unnecessarily polemical tone of Auditor-General's reports, particularly here in Victoria over the past period, in many ways the Auditor-General is quite right in highlighting, a less than optimum set of skills and therefore putting in front of public servants in Victoria a real set of challenges. I think there are issues in the context of program and project design, contract specification, contract management of many projects and programs. And I think if we're thinking about the public service of the future, then the development of those sorts of skills and the various accountabilities that relate to them are very important. Terry made, I think, one very salient point, and that is that we have a system where we have very poor accountability for poor performance. And I think much stronger performance management frameworks that relate that are very specifically performance related are critically important. The second point I'd like to make relates to something that Terry didn't raise, but I think is significantly important in the sort of context in which we have to operate. And that is the issue of the role of media and its impact on government. The imminent changes announced by Fairfax and News Limited are only the latest transformations which are occurring in a variety of media forms. What we're witnessing, I think, in many ways is an almost perfect storm, and the impacts of the new media environments are really lost on government. That is, how to manage that. And let me just suggest that there are sort of three interrelated trends that are occurring. The first, as we all know, is the staggering multiplication of new media forms and channels, all demanding to be filled with content, regardless of the quality of that content. This proliferation is often spoken of as the democratisation of media access. And whilst I think that's welcomed at one level, that trend often pits the blogger against the expert, with news being the so-called debate between the two, often between a debate between evidence and opinion. And this trend has contributed and is also a manifestation of the increasing dominance of a very strong tabloid approach to media content, an emerging domination of the media as entertainment. And this, combined with the increasing tendency of people to get their views through IT-based platforms, which enables one to flick back and forth page to page in an instant, means that it's increasingly difficult to explain complex issues to audiences with short concentration spans and the means to go elsewhere. And the third trend is the decline in the trust and attachment to long-standing important institutions. And Terry raised that in his presentation. And I think though some of the recent polling that we've seen, Terry referred to Crikey, also some reports out of Lowy, I think are very, very disturbing in terms of the declining trust in highly valued institutions like the High Court, like the RBA. And even more so, observations out of the recent Lowy survey, which had only 60% of Australians agreeing that democracy is preferable to any other kind of government. And for people 18 to 25, that was down to 39%. So the combination of these three factors, if they continue, I think is actually quite toxic. What we have is a public which is disengaged, which is cynical of spin, and spin seemingly is seen as anything that governments want to say, with short attention spans, susceptible to quick grabs. The slick three-word presentation, I think, is immensely powerful, which is highly individualistic, without a sense of the importance of the key institutions that we've had in this country. The importance of those institutions are to the very benefits that they receive as citizens. For governments, that means a tendency to populism and the lowest common denominator policies. It means also a reluctance to undertake innovation or to encourage innovation, because innovation, by necessity, means making mistakes. It means that, and when those mistakes are made, you have relentless media scrutiny of those so-called mistakes, which are used to make a judgment on the performance of governments as a whole. And for similar reasons, we're seeing an inertia against reform. And when reforms are undertaken, they become so compromised because the ability of local interests very vocal interests to oppose change, to an extent that many of the so-called reforms are useless, or certainly don't meet their objectives. And I think notwithstanding some of the important concepts underpinning the new carbon arrangements that are coming in, the fact that the carbon arrangements were supposed to send a price signal and be transformative, but in fact the results of what we have is that the price signals will be so blunted because pretty well everybody is going to get something in order to blunt that signal. Similarly, we've seen similar issues in relation to the mining taxes. So what does this mean for public services? More than ever, public services are going to need to provide and Terry made the comment earlier, need to focus on, in a sense, core skills, the provision of frank and fearless advice, but high quality evidence-based advice to executive government. It also means encouraging governments to communicate using ways beyond the press release and the Twitter. In fact, I can't think of anything worse than politicians engaging in 140 characters and thinking that they're communicating on any basis with their constituencies. Let me finish with a couple of comments about Terry himself and his career. He's always had a passion for public administration and policy reform, and we've seen that tonight in all the various roles that he's undertaken during his career. Not only did he talk about reform, but he's also undertaken reform. But always it's been within a sense of the traditions of our system of public administration. Terry is the only person I know who consciously seeks to trace his professional roots back to the Northcote Trevelyan Report of 1853, which set the framework for an apolitical public service in the United Kingdom. In that sense, Terry might be seen as a Burkean reformist, and Terry, I mean that in the nicest possible way.
Oh, that's high praise.
It is high praise. Terry's reformist zeal culminated, as you all know, in the development of what's now called the Moran Report. And that stands in a very strong tradition of Coombs and Walensky. And I think in the same way, it'll be seen to be contributing in future to the reshaping of the profession. It could be in many ways be seen as the third part of the Trinity. But I'll leave it to you to decide who's the Father, who's the Son, and who's the Holy Ghost. Thank you.